When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decade Project on One Heat Minute Productions Patreon. If you're listening to this right now in 2023, we are covering the films of 2013. And if you're listening in 2023, this means that you have been a patron. So thank you so much. If you're now listening to this as a film on the main feed, just know that next year, or the year that you're possibly listening to this, we are covering on the Patreon for the exclusive of about 11 months of the year. We cover the Decade Project looking back to films of 2014 for 24. One of the people who started this project with me a million years ago, it feels like now, on a canonical classic, Ridley Scott's The Counselor. It is my dear friend. He's a fantastic writer, a phenomenal interviewer, a terrific film critic, and a self-proclaimed darling. But, you know, he's a darling here as well. It's the great Isaac Fellberg. Hey, man, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Blake. Thank you for having me back. I'm honored to be one of your bookends.
You literally are. And it's perfect because it's like the two films that we're covering are two films by filmmakers made 10 years ago. And both of those filmmakers have films that are now like either out or, depending on where you are in the world, they're like out together, as strange as they seem. Two biopics. The first film we covered, Ridley Scott, obviously Napoleon is coming out in Oz. That's coming out in like a week, which is amazing. It's starting to get a wider release all around the world. And the film that we are covering today is by a filmmaker by the name of Sofia Coppola. She is an amazing filmmaker. She has a current film, Priscilla, which I'm dying to see. I'm seeing that in December in Oz. Again, the weird release international schedule of that. I'm so excited to see it. But today we are covering what I think is like an incredibly meditative and hypnotic. And at the time, I remember thinking, man, could teenagers be this awful? And 10 years later, the message of this film is an unequivocal yes. So we are going to talk about The
Girls,
Bling.
Time for your Adderall.
You know.
It's my homie Mark.
Hey.
Hi, I'm Nikki. This is Sam.
Hi.
Oh my God, that's Paris Hilton.
It's Kirsten Dunst.
I just think we wanted to be a part of like the lifestyle. The lifestyle that everybody kind of wants.
Hey, I can be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the vampire.
Paris Hilton's hosting a party in Vegas tonight.
Where does she live? Do you think we could find a way in?
I don't know.
Come on, let's go to Paris's. I want to rob.
I was in the 212 on the uptown.
Awesome.
You know what's up, or don't you?
Oh my God!
Rude bitch.
That's a cute dress. Did you get a new dress?
Mm-hmm.
We had so many beautiful things.
Oh, look great. I bet you do want to.
Ladies?
He looks hot.
I hear helicopters.
We're in LA. Don't be such a little bitch. You're stressing me out.
Oh my God, are they gone?
Police are investigating the connection of the Hollywood Hills burglaries.
America has this sick fascination with a Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing.
It all comes back to like bad choices. Who you have as your friend.
Can't take her dog.
But he likes me.
I'm a firm believer in karma. And I think this situation is a huge learning lesson for me to grow and expand as a spiritual human being. I want to lead a country one day, for all I know.
Did you speak to any of the victims?
I've spoken to all the victims.
Really? What did Lindsay say?
All right, Isaac, you chose this one. We chose The Counselor. I think we found each other staring like longingly at each other across Twitter going, Counselor, it's something that we need to both talk about. But The Bling Ring was the last one because I wanted to get you back on the show for the Decade Project again. The Bling Ring was one that you brought up and I hadn't seen it in an age and I watched it fresh for us to talk about. So tell me about why The Bling Ring particularly has resonated with you over the last decade.
It's, you know, it's so funny, especially with that preface of us having talked about The Counselor, because you're right that there are so many parallels between those films.
Oh, my God.
And I think one of the ones that you, another one to note is that there are two of maybe the lesser loved films by their directors. I think that when The Bling Ring came out, a lot of people dismissed it because it was a bit of a stylistic departure.
Yes.
And, you know, there was none of this sort of beautifully sort of soft, pastel-hued, fragrant sort of reverie that I think is so associated with Coppola's films, with The Virgin Suicides, with Lost in Translation.
Somewhere. Somewhere set around the same time is...
Right before.
Is a holistic... different experience. So yes, impressionistic and beautiful and like pondering the meaning of life. And it's, oh man, Stephen Dorff, like maybe career best, just oh, fantastic film. But this film, it commits to the bit of it's fucking ugly and it's gaudy. Yeah.
It's digital.
I was just watching it and I was like, oh, I get why people didn't like this, but I don't think they weren't on its frequency. And I think it's one of those things that like has a huge front running. Like it's like a front runner now, especially because in the age of TikTok, this thing is insane. Like you're watching it and you're like, oh, okay, I get it. We've caught up with it. Our culture is there. Like now every teenager are these teenagers.
Yes, absolutely. And it is one of those films where you look back on it and you see now what she was doing so much more clearly, because what was previously this sort of salacious case of teenagers who were trying to approximate celebrity, it now just seems that they were ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. You mentioned TikTok, and I think that social media has transformed and it's accelerated in a really rapid and scary way.
Yes.
But also an inevitable way. You just have to be on social media. But this film is set in 2008, and this was sort of a nexus point for so many different things that were happening, not only with our relationship to celebrity, but also our relationship to self and how we were projecting self into all of these different social media platforms that were just starting to emerge, like Facebook at that point in time, which is of course how The Bling Ring in some instances was able to track down information about their targets. But you know, now that you look at that, where we're at with social media, you also see in such a more kind of normalized way these parasitic parasocial relationships that people, that generation, especially younger generations, have with celebrity. And you know, 2008 was also a fascinating point to look at our relationship to materialism and consumerism, because there was at yes. once this reality TV boom exploding with Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie, The Simple Life, and with the Kardashians sort of coming out of Paris Hilton as well and exploding into that cultural craze.
Thank you, Paris. Thank you, Paris, for that.
Yes, thank you, Paris. We have Paris for so many things. It's like it's House of Wax and it is this massive, you know, celebrity confluence that we have in media at that point in time. I think that she's incredibly influential and continues to be in ways that aren't often recognized that much. She left the key under the mat, as it were.
Yes, but, you know, she sure did.
She sure did. But at the same time, there was this economic crash going on, and there was so much scarcity in the United States that was happening as well. And so you had this economic crisis that was happening at the same time that we were worshiping that wealth and that opulence of Hollywood. And, you know, what better vantage point than Calabasas to be just looking in at this suddenly like almost unreachable, but so close that you can touch it, or you can literally break in that level of celebrity affluence. And so it's just such a great time period to look back on and to realize how the stage was set for affluenza and for this kind of complete ability for a generation to be, you know, picturing themselves and projecting themselves into these lifestyles and not seeing anything wrong with that, because it's all that the media around them was telling them to do.
And it's also, you touched on so many great points there, but like one of them is, it's one of the first times with Paris, like the confluence of the fact that she was an heiress, number one, she'd come from a significant amount of money, and that her fame had been predicated, at least originally, on a sex tape being leaked. Like, let's not beat around the bush. Like, that's how she exploded onto every strata of pop culture, high and low art. And then she's being worshipped. And then even in the movie, and I was really looking to see if Paris had done a more in-depth interview on like what she thought of her portrayal of her house was in The Bling Ring. And it's nowhere to be found on the internet, or at least I wasn't able to find it in my looking over the last day or so. But it's like, this is a person who worships them, who worships the apparatus of her being worshipped. Like, she has pillows with her face on it. They walk into her house. Every magazine cover she's ever been on surrounds the well of the stairs in her home. It's just everywhere. It's this incredible thing. And the other thing is also, you know, there's such a high security culture, and in America, a paparazzi culture that's in LA. And so it kind of shows that, like, a bunch of dirtbag teenagers whose proximity to these people became so intoxicating that they couldn't help themselves but sort of peer in and like literally break into their lives, that it's like, oh, what massive impact did they then have on the community of like, oh, we've got to continue to keep ourselves separate. We've got to have these gated communities. We've got to have security. We've got to have 24/7 cameras all over those places. And it's just so funny. And the general apathy, you know, when you meet, if you've ever had any time interacting with like teens, they're obviously very self-involved. You know, it's hard to look, you remember your times in your life yourself where you're the biggest thing in the universe and there's nothing else. And you're just having a look at these kids just do this. And even just the mechanisms of like selfies and the mechanisms of like, one day I can go to a club and hook up and I might be famous. And that gap between being worshipped and being nothing is where this movie lives. And it's so, yeah, like I found it like, it's almost agonizing. And you know how talented she is as a formal stylist and how talented she is as a writer, but she's just making you relish in the ugly of all of this. And she's right there. She's like, this is like everything about our culture right now is gross. And she's unashamed to say it. And I think all the actors in this do their best to just be like, completely absent of emotions. Like, Emma Watson is outstanding. There's a great cast, but like at the time, a lot of people, it kind of had like a few mixed reviews. Like, it was all kind of mixed positive. But I think there was less, you know, some people thought it was a straight out satire. And I don't quite think it's a satire. Like, it doesn't feel like a satire to me. But, you know, Richard Brody is one. He had a great quote, which is like, daring to face these noxious, seemingly empty phenomena on an aesthetic terms and taking it on a degree of flatness and simplicity, Coppola renders them surprisingly substantial. And I'm like, he gets it. A kicker at the time, you're like, oh, he gets it. This is a film that the form and the function are harmonized so perfectly. And I think it is not fun. Like, it's not one that you're going to go back and revisit. It's not like Marie Antoinette, where it's like a party movie where you could have the whole movie playing on a screen and have music playing and you're hanging out with your friends eating dinner or whatever. It's not like that. Or like something you want to create space for, like Virgin Suicides. It's a mess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to think about it in connection to Marie Antoinette as well, not only just for like the montage sequences in it, yeah, that are quite similar, like I Want Candy and sort of rifling through the houses, but that I just think that, you know, one of her great subjects as a filmmaker is the isolation of privilege and just the way that it completely traps you in this strange bubble. And I think Brody, I mean, governing theme for any film podcast, Richard Brody is always right. But, you know, he gets it in a way that I think that so many people, including myself, just aspire to look at films in the way that he does. And but that idea of the flatness is just so, as you're saying, true to the subject of opulence that's built over this oblivion. And it's something that's at once like just the way that I think maybe Coppola's looking at that lifestyle of the rich and famous, of, you know, people who became famous for doing very little, or in the instance of, you know, Paris Hilton or Kim Kardashian, because of course, you know, Kardashian came after, but that question of like, you know, how much should we be worshiping these people for their sex tapes, and to what degree are we exploiting them as we're elevating them? It's a very like kind of dicey relationship to fame that was happening at the same time that media was dramatically expanding the arenas in which you could be famous with the internet.
Yes. Yes.
And
so
by the time, but it's the gap between Paris and Kim Kardashian is like, with Paris, it was like a scientific experiment where no variables were measured. It was like, we have no assumptions, we have no hypothesis, we're going to mix these elements together, and we don't actually know how they're going to react. And with Paris, it took an immense amount of time, you know, like, this sex tape happens, she explodes, she comes on, she does reality TV shows, she stars in films, she becomes a bit of a mogul as far as like the money that she uses, she actually uses it to her great advantage and becomes, you know, an extremely wealthy person, real estate, etc., other entrepreneurial things that she invests in. And then she becomes, and then she essentially like slowly retreats from the spotlight and becomes this sort of like former royal, if you like, that's just sort of goes off to the side. And then she pops up now and then, but she is like, she took being completely out of control, all these elements, and now just like lives her life, has a stack of money, occasionally pops up on a magazine feature for a marriage or something like that. Extremely controlled within an inch of its life. And the gap between her and Kim Kardashian is like, they weaponized the gap of put the sex tape out, make it show industry, but, and they're like, that's the thing that freaks me out about this movie, is like, you see the how the culture at the time and these kids surrounding it, but it's like the gap between knowing how to navigate it and having no clue about its power was also very short, was really short.
Absolutely.
And
so, there's that. Oh, sorry.
No, please go.
I was just going to say as well that there's such a thing that you can kind of pull on there with Paris and Kim about their reactions to those sex tapes when they leaked, and just what ended up happening in the aftermath of that. Essentially, I mean, the fact that Paris never really saw a dime for that sex tape coming out. She was not happy about it. She was really, you know, traumatized by it, she said at different points in time. But that the release of that was something where I think, you know, you're negotiating that gulf between the self as commodity and, you know, how much you're willing to exploit yourself. Whereas Kim Kardashian leaned into it ultimately, and I believe, you know, agreed to the release of the tape after a $5 million settlement. And that was, and kind of turned it to her advantage in this way that really it teed up what happened next with that family becoming a reality TV empire, and or a dynasty, if you like, to use that royal term. But they, I think, really embody that idea of how you can take your image and turn it into a symbol and still sort of exercise control over it, but only at the expense of your entire life becoming that. and
wait, can we just pause on that amazing sentence? Only at the expense of your entire life. Like, I just like, it's just like, yeah, you can control it if you are willing to sacrifice everything for the purpose of that fame. Like, that is the only currency the currency of the fame and then how it equates directly to monetary advantage. Like what, it, like right. if you're willing to just, you are co-opted, you're a brand identity, you are the fucking Bugs Bunny of your own Warner Brothers universe. Like, it's insane. It's insane.
It is. And those glass houses that are everywhere in the Bling Ring. I think that, you know, there's so much around the transparency of that and just the idea that you can turn your life into a hall of mirrors and, you know, especially like, you know, using the wands in everyone's pockets. It's just like this, this endless amount of refracting surfaces that you can project your image out through into the entire world. And it, I think that has only sped up, if anything, since this movie came out. But just while we're on the subject of that, it's a really interesting thing to think about in relationship to the Bling Ring because of the characters in this movie, like the character Alexis, who's played by Emma Watson, who was filming a reality TV show at the time that she was.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Committing these robberies. She was doing a pilot for a season of a TV show called I Think Pretty Wild that ended up becoming basically a document because she got arrested right after the pilot was shot. And so the season is kind of her doing the reality TV stuff of like living this lifestyle with her family. And there's a lot in there about her relationship with her mother and that the vision boards that they introduced that we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a little bit.
Oh my God.
But it's also this really disturbing sort of season of television leading up to her trial date, around which she was also put into a rehab clinic for black tar heroin addiction. And so there's like this incredible, like, sort of at once advantage and exploitation that's going on with people who are even tangentially or parasitically attached to that celebrity complex that's going on. And it just feels like such a beast to try to ride out. It makes me really admire the Kardashians in a perverse way that they've been so successful in doing it as this family holding the reins, because we see and have seen in so many different instances how that is something that can completely buck you off or destroy your entire life, even though you feel like you're in control right up until that instance.
There is an amazing critical theorist. You just got to go find her stuff. It's called Kardashian Colloquium, and where she talks about the way, like, it's she's on Instagram. She does these amazing, and I think she's on TikTok too. Does these amazing videos, and she just talks about like the way that the Kardashian family co-opt different tenets of pop culture and sort of absorb them in a way so that they can continue to reinforce their position at that height. And so like some of the more like, I guess you would say like almost like mercenary laser focus, but also deeply sometimes like maybe accidentally intellectual, but like intellectual things of like, I need to wear the Marilyn Monroe dress and I need to do this and I need to have this position and I need to go and do this show at this time. And she's an absolutely fantastic critical theorist that applies her gaze to the Kardashians almost exclusively. So she's like she's someone I've never really watched an episode of the Kardashians, but man, I will follow her Instagram so much because I'm like, this is fascinating. I need to know about the pinnacle of pop culture, really pop culture, as much as movie heads like you and I are like, well, movies aren't the pinnacle of pop culture anymore. For the widest possible audience, it's like these social media moguls that become so influential. But like this cast, I have to shout them out. Like Katie Chang is amazing. She plays Rebecca. She's absolutely unbelievable. She's probably one of the, you know, if you grew up, there was always the girl who seemed wise beyond her years, and you, especially as a young man, like you're like completely scared of the entire world. And there's always that one girl who's like incredibly confident and has like a brio that you can't quantify. And she just has that in this group. And Israel Brassard's Mark is like, that's him. Great cast, Teresa Farmiga, Georgia Rock, Claire Julian, all really great. Leslie Mann is so Leslie Mann is the satire. She's the queen, right? She's the satire of the movie, of like the mother with the vision boards talking about Angelina Jolie. Like, she is outstanding in this movie. But that whole cast of teens are just so funny, because they're just so like, they do not equate, even though they are themselves kind of low middle class, they do not equate any capacity at all that anyone works for anything. So there's no meaning to ownership or value or acquisition of things. It's just like going into someone's house and taking a $5,000 bag and leaving is just as natural as going to buy a burger from McDonald's and handing over $2. Like there's no disconnect between those things. And I think that that's pretty incredible. The way that they're kind of harnessed there.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that that's perfectly put, what you just said, the idea of this generation that has no real sense of self, because they have no sense of reality. Yeah. Beneath the objects, the object is reality, and yes, it's just this—it's this incredible kind of portrait of that generation that also is so borne out by the way that that the cinematographer, the late great Harris Avidis, shot this film, where it's just this, and that was also a bit of a change for him, like shooting in digital for this movie. But I think it's perfect. It's that veneer over an emptiness. And I think it completely captures what you're talking about, which is that in lieu of any sort of deeper meaning that they can attach to this wealth, the wealth itself is the meaning, and the image is the identity. It's that external sort of idea of you are what you wear that I think was also really huge in fashion at that point in time, with everyone wearing all these different brands and TMZ harping on everyone's fashion choices, different brands starting to partner with celebrities about, it's not that you're wearing, you know, this specific designer, it's that you're wearing Paris Hilton, or you smell like Paris Hilton. And it's like that, everything about that external projection, I think, feeds into this movie. And it negates the formation of any kind of identity outside of those objects that you could accrue.
And it's only the smallest amount of time. Firstly, I just want to touch on Harris Avidis. May he rest in peace, one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. Who knows if this is true, but the trivia is on this is that the dialogue-free, very slow zoom shot of the robbery in the glass house, based on the pacing of the movie, even though it's a 90-minute film, was considered to be cut. And Harris Avidis lobbied Sophia to say no, it has to stay. And now it's ultimately like the iconic celebrated shot of the film. So yeah, like that was, that's a bit of trivia on that. But I also love this. It's like that thing, you know, I had a friend recently tell me, he's like, have you ever thought about changing your phone to grayscale? And I was like, oh, what do you mean? And he's like, oh, you can change the colors on your phone. You can turn it into black and white. And it's like the black and white doesn't give you the same dopamine as color. And he's like, sometimes I feel like when I'm into my phone too much, I go into the settings and I turn it to black and white, because then I can actually leave it. You know, I can stop myself from touching it. And I think about that so much in the context of watching this movie, because like they go and steal this stuff. They're doing these perilous theft jobs, as clumsy and as weird and like awful as they do, and getting away with it. They do these little jobs. And then like there's this great shot which has the emptiness and soullessness of like waiting in a hospital, of them selling the bags on like sunset, like, or selling them down at the beach. And you're like, the dopamine hit that they got is gone now. The currency of the tens of thousands of dollars of designer shit means nothing to them. They don't want it. They're going to sell it for $50 over there, get a passive $50, spend that $50 out tonight going out. And then the next day they're going to need the dopamine hit. And it feels like the apparatus of social media is almost like being essayed in that scene of like, we go and do this crazy thing. We get our dopamine hit. We do it. We go out. We hold it once, just like a celebrity sometimes does. And this is like that weird cycle of celebrities. Like they get like a $20,000 dress. They wear it to one event and it's done. You're never wearing it again. You know, right. And, you know, I think some of us do that. Sometimes you wear like a really fancy shirt or a fancy suit for a very special occasion. Like I'm thinking of it in my only context I have for this is like my wedding suit and I've never worn it again. Like it's like I wore it. It was a great suit. I could probably wear it again. Just have it because there was that one special thing and there's 25 photos of it in my house and I'm not going to wear, I don't need to wear it ever again. But it's like, it's that thing where nothing lasts in this movie about it. Nothing lasts. It's just like, yeah. Okay, cool. We're going to go and sell it for nothing on the street. It doesn't matter.
I hope that the wedding suit has slightly more lasting value to use.
No, it has a huge amount of value. I'm not selling that on a beach. It's always hanging up. But I mean, like, that's the only thing that I can equate it to because like, I'm not like a celebrity who's getting gifted like $20,000 right. jackets no, just because I'm going to an event, you know, like again, as she said, Sofia Coppola having that understanding and essaying privilege. It's like, yeah, things change when you've got that level of privilege for the actual celebrity. But in the movie, what's even funnier is these kids have none of that privilege, but they start to then be so callous and discard things because it's like they've got this, like, as you said, this parasitic privilege now because they've been sort of taking it away. And it's like, oh my God, like,
absolutely. It's and that's the psychology that they're trying to channel is the psychology of someone who's rich and famous and therefore doesn't have a care in the world in their view, because all they ever see is these images of these celebrities wearing all of these expensive clothes once and then discarding them. And it's a huge part of why they want to kind of do these robberies in the first place. So they're like, she's not using any of this stuff. And it doesn't mean that they're going to use it. But at least they can, like, you know, have their chance to try it on. And like, that's sort of the sort of the force that's driving them. It is an addiction and it is a compulsion just to sort of see themselves in that way. And I think so much of the movie is about that sort of superficiality as being a goal in of itself.
Yes.
If they thought about it too much, it would defeat the purpose.
Yes.
Which is just, I think, such an interesting way to look at not only the sort of delusions of grandeur of someone who's existing in relationship to the celebrity complex, but also the mind of teenagers, which is another great subject of this film that we're talking about. And just the sort of way that at that age, you are trying things on and taking them off and figuring out what is going to become a part of your identity and what is just a phase. Or what is something that you don't actually see yourself in? And I think you see a lot of that with the character of Mark, where he's trying on the heels and he's like, you know, just trying to kind of get a sense of all of these different ways that he could see himself. And I think that he's the way into this group in a lot of senses, because he's the person who just wants to make friends. He's just moved to this town. And I think that there's a lot there about the precarity of that, of not really knowing who you are, but needing to project who you are at all times.
And not knowing who you are and then being with a bunch of people like where your impulse is to ingratiate yourself, where your impulse is to conform, is to get into the group, and being in being in a group where there are elements that are doing stuff that are not anywhere on the same plane as your morality normally. And you just sort of but acting so casually, and that thing of like, the last thing I want to seem is like a wet blanket or uncool, because I'm going to lose the very few friends that I have in this environment as I do. So I'm just going to keep doing these things, even though they're insane. Like, he is begrudgingly doing a lot of this, or at least the character is portrayed in that way. He's begrudgingly doing a lot of this, does have that sort of pattern awareness about it. But yeah, it's like, that's why it's precarious with teenagers. You're like, yeah, that's not a good person to hang around, but they can't, you have no context. You have no frame of reference. You're just living every day as a day. You're making the choices on the day, the best ones. Often they're bad. And it takes a lot more, like, that's why teenagers to me, and even Paris Hilton and this thing, it was like this sort of perennial, like, 16-year-old girl persona that Paris had, this like lack of awareness. And it never fascinated me in as much as it was always like, God, she's going to be fascinating when she's 30. You know, like she's going to, well, I would love to hear her talk now, to hear what her life is like and her to reflect on this stuff. But like when you're in it, teenagers are not interesting. And you as a teenager yourself were not the most interesting version of yourself. Like I joke around and say like I was like a high functioning ape until like 25. And then I was like, oh, I'm a person now. Like, this is good. You know, I could actually be who you want to be in your life because you kind of have had some experiences and you get it. But here they're like fast forwarding. They don't know who they are, number one. They're in the precarious situation of being in near all these unlocked homes, watching people who are worshipped around the world right next to them. And they're so close to it that they can touch it. And of course, a teenager's impulse is going to be to push. It's going to be to skip. And all you need is like one or two friends who like are blissfully unaware or like aggressively laissez-faire about consequences. And because that's the other big thing about a crime and teenagers movie. When you're coming from this position of privilege, the inference is you're always going to be able to get out of it. There's always some backup. Whereas like you go to a low socioeconomic community and you fucking break into someone's house who's not rich and you're going to jail. Like that's the other big the thing. And I think Sofia Coppola is completely aware of it, is like the inference is these kids will always get away with this. They are going to get away with this shit. It does not feel like there's any kind of peril. But you watch a movie with, you know, John Singleton made in fucking 91, and these kids like walk past a white person's house and they're going to jail. Like you know, like whereas here, no consequences. There's no consequences for these bad behavior.
No. And you know, I think ultimately they ended up serving like 4 years collectively.
Collective. They break into like 20 houses, steal thousands of dollars, like 4 years collectively.
Right. Because, and you know, the thing of it is like, you know, and Emma Watson's character, the way that she describes it, that she's a firm believer in karma and she just believes the situation was attracted into her life as a huge learning lesson. And it's just like that level of just complete, that level of complete self-centeredness and egotism as being the thing that both drove the behavior and is the ultimate takeaway as well. It's just like these kids are like black holes. They're just pulling everything in because there's nothing at their center. And it just like, it compacts all of the things that they experience in their life into fodder for whatever they're gonna like, you know, say next. But there's no real thought driving it. And I find that character so interesting because she's so ambitious and wants absolutely nothing. She has no idea. she has no idea what she wants to do other than what she is kind of doing in the moment. And that character, if I'm remembering correctly, is sort of brought in. I think she's named Nikki in the movie, not Alexis, but she's playing Alexis.
Yeah, it's not Alexis in the movie. In the movie, it is. Oh, sorry, I'll get the name too, because yeah, it's Nikki. You're right.
Yeah, it's Nikki. I just wanted to clarify that, but because I feel like I am conflating the real person with the character.
I want to rob,
which is like, I don't know if she said that, but she definitely said the karma thing.
Yes.
And you know, that's like one of the things where, you know, Sophia is just not, you were saying earlier, you don't really see the film as a satire, and I agree, but she does let them just kind of like have enough of the rope to hang themselves at different points in time. And like a lot of the quotes, especially once the police catch up with them, are direct out of introduced from them.
The only reason I don't qualify it as a satire, Isaac, and this is just like it's probably semantics at this point, but it's just like when people are in and of themselves a satire, like the words coming out of their mouth are satirical, like seem satirical to rational human beings, I'm like, that's not a satire. That's just great. Like, that's just the craziness of the world. Like that karma speech and all that sort of stuff. It's like, no, that's just the world. That's just how crazy this situation was and is. Look, it has been super fun talking to you about this movie. Like it's a movie that, unlike any of the other decade projects that we've done, it is a movie that like, you throw it on and it is as biting and incisive and prescient as ever. In fact, it seems like it front runs some of the bigger and more, I guess, sophisticated thoughts about the evolution of our culture based on social media. And she's so aware of it. And I think that it's only Sofia Coppola's vantage of a kid who grew up in privilege and then struck out to make, to have her own individual identity and artistic footprint, that she can have such a level of like heightened understanding of these things and then choose how to deploy it. So, man, thank you for choosing it. Thank you for bringing it to us. And I love you and you're fantastic. And I'm so looking forward to anything else that you do. And you have to promise me before we go that there's some 2014 movies that are percolating in your mind so that you come back and do a couple of decade projects with us next year.
Oh, absolutely. If you're continuing this, I'll be right back here. I should mention as well that I have read some incredible scholarship around The Bling Ring, and I need to especially shout out Hannah Strong, who's written a book.
Right.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with Hannah Strong.
I know Hannah Strong. Yeah, she's terrific. She's terrific. Yeah, I know Hannah. We haven't interacted, but I'm a if Hannah happens to listen to this, I'm a fan of her work. I've heard her on pods. I'm a fan.
Yeah, she's brilliant, and her book is called Forever Young. It's out from Little White Lies Press, and it takes a lot of Sophia's films, everything, I think, you know, pre-Priscilla, and binds it together into these different themes of celebrity and excess and adolescence, and she brings this personal perspective to it that's really quite extraordinary, and I would just really recommend that anyone who's interested in The Bling Ring or anything else that this filmmaker has made, I consider that to be one of the essential texts on her at this stage in her career.
Unbelievable. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, and it's always great talking to you. Take care, and I can't wait to chat again soon.
Thanks so much, Blake. It's been a pleasure.